Welcome to the Gordon Asset Management Podcast, a show for savers, investors, and entrepreneurs, helping you to stay informed, invest wisely, and achieve the unimaginable. Now, on to the show.
Hey, everybody. This is Todd Zempel with Gordon Asset Management, and today we have a very special edition of the podcast. Riding shotgun with me, we have Joe Gordon and JT Stille. And our very special guest, we have the one and only father of the 401k, Mr. Ted Benna. Ted is actually the gentleman who started the modern 401k. So, Ted, welcome to the show.
Hey, Todd, I'm glad to be with you guys today.
Thanks, Ted. And so I'd like to start. I think it would be great for our listeners to hear the story of the modern 401k. You can go back as far as you like, but we'd like to hear it from the father himself.
Okay. Well, it's kind of tough to decide how much of this to get into, Todd. I guess I'll start, with the law that enabled it, and not get into what happened before that, but the enabling legislation was passed in the fall of 1978. It was included in the Tax Revenue Act of 78, and probably a couple interesting things about that is, first of all, it was only a page and a half long. What it did was add paragraph K to section 401 of the IRS code. So it was only a page and a half long. And the other thing your listeners need to know is that this wasn't intended to be a big deal by any means. It was a little section snuck into an end of the year tax bill. And, there wasn't any member of Congress here that was trying to champion what was going to become the primary way of saving for retirement today. And so, I've been quoted incorrectly as having discovered this buried in the IRS code, and that certainly isn't true. I saw it when it was enacted in 1978, and others who follow this type of law had done so also. Effective date of it wasn't until January of 1980. So January of 1980 came and went. No one was putting 401k plans in place because it wasn't expected to be a big deal. And so what happened in the fall of 1980, I was working on redesigning the retirement program for Philadelphia Area Bank. And as I was working on doing that, I was drawn back to this section of the code, and what the bank was attempting to do, their desire was to eliminate a cash bonus plan. And, that's what this section of the law was oriented towards doing, was enabling employers to put in place what were known as cash deferred employer funded profit sharing plans. And the way this could be done, for the bank, for example, is they would have been able to eliminate the cash bonus program and put in place a new retirement program where each employee would have the opportunity to determine how much of that cash bonus coming for the employer would be set aside for retirement and how much would be taken as cash. But a key to making this thing work for the higher paid employees was getting broad participation from the lower paid employees. And I knew at that time that a little bit of tax savings wasn't going to be sufficient, to get a bank teller to give up a $500 bonus and save a few bucks in taxes. So I came up with the idea of adding an additional incentive, which would be an employer matching contribution. So I could go out and present this and say, hey, look, if you do this, you'll get a tax break, but you also get some additional money from the bank. And that was the first key. The next is, once I got to that point, I realized there's an opportunity actually here to provide a way for employees to actually take part of their salary and have it go into this type of program as an employee pre-tax contribution. And there wasn't anything, you know, in the law that said you could do either one of those, but there also wasn't saying anything there saying thou shalt not. So I chose to take off with a more aggressive interpretation. That's sort of the, you know, the key background on it, Todd.
Yeah, and so thanks for providing that background. So instrumental to all this, so do you recall what the marginal tax rate was at that particular point in time in the late 70s?
Yeah, it was up in the 70% or higher range. So, you know, I've often been asked, did you expect this thing to become a big thing? And, yeah, once I put those two pieces together, I knew it was going to get big. It was simply a matter of how fast and how quick. And the reason for that was the large companies, you know, many of the Fortune 500 companies had in place what were known as thrift or savings plans, where employees were, you know, putting money in after tax and getting a match from the employer. And I knew, you know, once we started to get publicity that, hey, here's a way now, instead of putting your money in, you know, after tax, you could do it pre-tax. I knew senior execs in big companies who are putting $20,000, $30,000 a year in after tax at a, you know, 70% marginal tax rate were sure as heck going to get arrested, you know, real fast in changing to a pre-tax alternative.
You know, what I was obviously active in the industry. This is Joe speaking. One of the things that I thought was remarkable about 401k development in the 80s was that pretty much most employees, especially in big companies, were fairly withdrawn from the whole retirement plan scene. They only got a statement once a year, and there was no such thing as participant elections. And like you say, it was just maybe some after-tax thrift savings plans with matches and things like that. But I noticed that a lot of employers were telling me in the 80s that employees were really starting to get engaged. In fact, I used to have many companies look across the table and kind of laugh and say, you know what, when we used to spend 10% on profit sharing, nobody cared. Now we're matching 50% up to 6% of pay, and they think this is the greatest thing they've ever seen in life. Would you care to comment on that?
Yeah, that's all certainly true. And well, there are two different types of plans. You know, one were the employer-funded profit sharing, and yeah, I'll pass on that for a moment. We'll come back to that later. But the other were these after-tax thrift savings plans. You know, those, Joe, were primarily glorified Christmas clubs. You know, they were in the big companies like IBM's and so forth. And what happened is most of the employees made after-tax contributions all year long. And at the end of the year, they were allowed to take out the employer money that had been in the plan for at least 2 years. So what happened was in December, you know, 90% or so of the employees would strip out as much money as they could, you know, use it at that time of year. So what happened with those employers, they simply added a pre-tax option and said to employees, well, you can continue to do the Christmas club thing and put your money in after tax and, you know, take it out the year end, or you can put it in pre-tax and you get the tax break. But now there's a catch to doing that. You know, if you go that route, you're going to have to leave the money in there and you'll have access to it only for financial hardship. So what happened in the big companies is that transition began to take place. And one of the major one of the big companies, first one that I worked with was Bethlehem Steel. In my first meeting with them, I met with probably about 15 of their senior execs. And I made the comment in that meeting that, hey, look, it's time for your employees to start saving for retirement. And I was politely told by the HR director that, hey, our employees don't have to do that. We take care of them forever. You know, we give them this pension and they get lifetime health care coverage. So that was the world in the big companies. And, we'll pick up then, you know, on the profit sharing, and I'll let you comment on this, and then we'll come back to the profit sharing type plans, Joe.
Yes, so since you'd mentioned Bethlehem Steel, are they in the club that eventually filed for bankruptcy and dumped their pension liabilities on the PBGC?
Yeah, within a couple years after this meeting, they were in court for the first time attempting to ratchet down their retiree health care coverage. And, not terribly long after that, yes, they ended in bankruptcy and went totally out of business, dumped their liabilities on PBGC, correct?
Yeah, I think Billy Joel wrote a few songs about that. Was it Allentown? The steel company went out of business. So in the 80s, also one thing I wanted to get your reaction to today, I'm sure you remember that I believe it was the first time that Congress tried to save Social Security for 75 years, led by Claude Pepper. They, in that reform bill, I believe it was 82 or 83. They also took away the payroll tax deferral that you got on 401k deferrals. So what did you think about that? Do you think Congress should restore it now? Because it clearly was a big disincentive back then. And since HSAs get payroll tax savings and federal and state income tax deferral, do you think it's appropriate that that be restored?
It's not going to happen. I mean, this is one of those crazy things, you know, where people say, well, yeah, why are tax laws the way they are? Well, they're bizarre, you know, they're not consistent. And, you know, there's an even a bigger one in healthcare, totally. And that is the fact that it's completely a tax giveaway. I mean, the, employer-funded healthcare benefits, it's a form of compensation, but there's never any tax liability, which is, an even bigger issue, than the one you're talking about.
You're very, very true. And that worked its way in the code back in the 40s during the World War II. And the free wages were frozen. So the unions had to find other ways to get benefits to their workers.
All right. Not to mention corporate tax rates were north of 50% back then as well.
Yeah.
Which provided an incentive to fund pension.
And health.
But you mentioned employer-funded profit-sharing plans, Joe. And, that was... among smaller employers that typically they didn't have pension plans. If they had any retirement program, it would have been an employer-funded profit-sharing plan. And, we administered a bunch of those. And, there were some of them where the employers were very generous and were contributing, 10, 15% of pay every year into them, which was fantastic. But, more typically, the employers were contributing somewhere between 0 and 5%, into those plans, which certainly was not enough to provide an adequate retirement. So, what eventually happened was all those employer-funded profit-sharing plans, got converted to a combination of a 401k with a match, and then potentially, in addition, returning. Retaining some employer profit sharing element as well, is what happened to them.
Yeah, and that's so true because in my experience, I think in the 80s, I probably 3 out of 4 401k plans I was involved in were just simply amending existing profit sharing plans and adding section 401k. So obviously things have morphed a lot since the 80s. And so I know you've written a number of articles in the last 4 or 5 years in particular about you're not satisfied with the beast that you created. Can you comment a little bit on where you see things today and the state of the 401k? And if you could weave a wand, what changes would you make?
The area I was most concerned about when I've gotten quoted in terms of being quite unhappy about it is really in the area of fees. And, what happened there is in the early days, all the administrative and non-investment fees were paid by the employer, not the participants. And so what happened, and I've covered this, in my latest book, 401k 40 years later, I cover in detail the history of how fees evolved. And so the first shot at it was, for large employers, started the trend of going into what were known as bundled arrangements, where they could turn a plan over to Fidelity, for example, and have all the costs now picked up by the participants rather than the way they were here to begin with. That was the first stage. And, you know, and then the next was, you know, we got, you know, other entities involved, you know, the financial organizations, you know, the wirehouse firms, et cetera, realized, hey, there's money to be made here. And, you know, so they got in the game and we had, you know, different, another layer of fees that happened. And then the last one that really ticked me off the most, because I helped open the gate with Department of Labor for participants to be able to get investment advice, was for that to be misused by adding an additional layer of fees, typically, you know, somewhere in the 1% range, so that we went, you know, in a situation where small plans may have fees as high as 2.5% to 3% a year, which is, you know, pretty outrageous.
Well, I can tell you there were plans with higher fees than that in the 80s, and in particular delivered through life insurance companies that were entering the 401k business. In fact, at one point, and I won't name the name of the insurance company, I think I had a commission playbook that was about an inch thick of different methods of compensation you could select based on cash flows and things like that. The abuses I actually saw in the 80s were primarily people that were selling these plans and requiring up to 25% be allocated to guaranteed issue universal life, or up to 50% in whole life. There was a lot of that going on, and then actually waiving a lot of the direct fees because of all the money being made by the agent, servicing, broker, whatever, on the plans. And there was no transparency in fees. As you said, the bundled arrangements, is not, nobody really knew. And again, we were kind of in a bull market. Nobody really cared, I thought, for a good while, until we hit the recession in the early 90s and things started to change a bit.
Yeah, and that was back in the day when 401ks were free, right? Because there was no fee disclosure, and it was pretty grotesque what was going on behind the scenes. But as a result, now we're all subject to fee disclosure regulations under ERISA 408b2 and 404a5. Ted, do you think those fee disclosure regulations were positive? Do you think we got it right, or should we have tweaked those regulations?
Well, they absolutely are necessary, Todd. But unfortunately, even with that, I still run into plans now where I see fees as high as, you know, 2.75%. And what's happened, and it's hard to really understand, is that when the employer doesn't have to write out a check to pay fees, they've become largely indifferent too often, you know, to how much they're paying, you know, because it doesn't affect them. And what's really kind of amazing to me in the smaller market, you know, is the largest account balances are the owners and obviously the execs. And, you know, so they're the ones underwriting, you know, those fees out of their, tax exempt account. They'd be better off actually, having an employer pay fees, which would be deductible, and getting a better deal for their participants, and especially including themselves. You know, just not a good structure.
Right. And so the other thing that we have seen a lot of lately are the lawsuits, mostly from the, Schlichter, Beauregard, Denton law firm. Schlichter, Jerry Schlichter in particular, has raised a lot of these class action lawsuits against employers, and he's led a lot of that. And then there's been other lawyers that have followed suit, basically taking his lawsuits and carbon copying them, and basically creating more class action lawsuits. So that has been a huge driver in our eyes of fee deflation, which is, you know, it's a double-edged sword. I think to some degree, yes, it's driven down participant fees, which is good, but it's also scared a lot of plan sponsors into just, you know, flipping the switch and saying, I'm going to take the easy way out and you know, provide index funds without regard to, you know, performance and that type of thing. Any thoughts on the litigation?
Well, it's definitely had an impact. I mean, I've been an expert witness in some cases, and you know, tell you a story about one of them that's just incredible. You know, the primary issue was company stock in that one, and I won't mention the name. You know, it was a big company, but when you're in that process, the discovery process, you have the right to get your hands on, you know, all the records that exist. And so one of the things I had the opportunity to review were the minutes of the committee the company had in place overseeing the pension plan and also their 401k. And they were overseeing about $2 billion a year. And I could give you a number of stories about that, but the most astounding one was a set of minutes from their annual meeting of overseeing these funds that only lasted a half an hour. It was only half an hour long.
Right, for $2 billion in assets. Yeah, that's crazy. We see the same thing. You know, sometimes when we're engaged, we'll get to see the prior meeting minutes as well. And we see the same things where it's just, you know, just very basic and sad what has been documented and looked at and whatnot.
So, Ted, Joe again, interested to hear your views on this new legislation effective the first of the year, pooled employer plans. Do you have any thoughts on that? And will that be? We're hearing on both sides. Some are not excited about it. Some think it's only for small plans. Some think it's for audited plans that have less in assets, but you know, enough people to be subject to audit. And it seems like there's a couple different twists that certain providers are putting on how to do them based on their legal counsel. So, do you have any comment on that you want to share?
Yes, good and bad, Joe. And thanks for asking. You know, the good part potentially is this may be a way to further reduce fees. You know, hopefully that will happen. I, from past experience, have concern about it may, in fact, also result in increased profitability for people, you know, in this business rather than reducing fees. So we'll see how that plays out. But probably the number one issue for me is the fact that many small employers are inappropriately being sold 401k plans. And, you know, 401k isn't the best alternative for them. You know, you mentioned, Joe, earlier, the concern about suits, et cetera. And so I spent, you know, the last 3 years working on tweaking IRA-based employer-provided plans that can provide benefits comparable to 401k without any setup fees, you know, annual fees, liability exposure, all the complexity, you know, you got to deal with a 401k. And I'm talking now primarily about the non-professional market, you know, solo entrepreneurs, sole proprietors, and, you know, we're owners that are, you know, typically earning $100,000 a year or less. So, you know, these are a lot better alternatives. And too often, you know, they're being pushed into 401ks because that's what typical investment advisors are trained to sell. You know, that's the game.
Yeah, yeah, no, there's no doubt about that, because clearly, you know, a simple IRA would be probably a better budgetable solution and devoid of most fees, hopefully. But we've seen even in simple IRA plans that they're putting in the alphabet soup of mutual fund shares, A, B, and C shares. So it just depends on that advisor to do the right thing. And sometimes left to their own devices, they look at their wallet first.
Yeah, and too often, I mean, I keep running into them where, you know, they're being sold, for example, a solo 401k. Had one recently where that happened. You know, the solo entrepreneur, she's making about $65,000 a year net, and you know, putting $16,000 into a solo K and $6,000 into a Roth IRA, and you know, I thought, well, hey, this is fantastic. You know, the advisor's done a great job. Then I started to peel the layers off and dug underneath and found out, the way it was set up, it was costing her close to $3,000 a year of additional taxes that she could be saving that, wasn't happening. And, when it was pointed out, the advisor, he continued to, failed to even, I guess, recognize the fact that, the operation structure hadn't been done right.
Got it.
Wow. So going forward, what are some areas that you're thinking about? What are some things you think we can do to improve the retirement industry in general?
Well, as far as changing 401k, first of all, when I do interviews, and I get them from the professional financial writer community, and they want to play that game and say, well, if we just threw everything out and started over, what would you do? And I say, hey, I don't even want to go there, because the reality is political potential of that happening is highly unlikely. So why waste time? Okay. So I say, look, if you want to talk about things that may have some potential politically of happening, well, let's do that. And so that's kind of things I would mention here. The first one, there's continuing agony over the fact that too much of the money that goes into these retirement programs doesn't stick. It gets pulled out when there's changes in jobs. And so, I recommend putting the lid on that and requiring that when employees change jobs, the money has to stick into, a retirement account. Why give a 30-year-old with $10,000 a decision to make of, hey, do I buy a new car or do something else with this money? We'll have to close that door. Another one that I would like to see would be requiring auto enrollment for all plans. If you have a plan, you have to auto enroll and you have to auto increase contributions, on an annual basis up to, up to some limit. The next one would be to provide a tax incentive for locking into a guaranteed lifetime income annuity. And, the reason for that is that most individuals who are in these plans have limited amount available when they're retiring. They only have millions of dollars. They've got maybe a quarter of a million or half a million or whatever. And, making that, converting that into an income stream that will last for 20, 30 years is a big issue. And I would like to see a tax incentive that, the first 1,000 or maybe 2,000 a month of annuitized income wouldn't be taxed, to provide a way of encouraging that. And I guess the last thing, I would like to see a mandate that all employers have to offer some form of payroll deduction. And, that's controversial, but, I've run small businesses and, it's not that big a deal. And the reason I would require that is clearly the biggest advantage 401k provides is converting spenders into savers by making saving the first priority. And all employees should have that opportunity.
Yeah. And, that's been one of the main messages out of ASPA, the American Retirement Association, NAPA, the last 5 to 10 years, was that workplace savings plans has really converted a lot of people from spenders into savers. And I think it's over 74% or some number that are given the opportunity to participate. They actually do so at some level. So I think you're spot on that.
Yeah, and I have many participants over the years, younger ones and also retirees, have said, hey, I want to thank you, for this, because otherwise I wouldn't have achieved what I've been able to achieve. Wouldn't have happened. Hey, and I know I got to confess that's true of me. When I started putting money in when, had a decent sized mortgage and four children, and, if it, wasn't happening out of the paycheck, not likely to have happened otherwise.
One of the funny things that made me think about your whole career trip with 401k just now was that, actually discovering that page and a half was kind of an unintended consequence, and then it morphed into something totally unimaginable to what it is today. And And it makes me also think about the 86 Reform Act that once the IRS wrote regulations, and I think they were released in 1989, all these actuaries at the annual ASPA meeting were talking about, oh, my God, there's this thing called new comparability they created. They've actually now allowed defined benefit formulas and profit sharing plans. And so then you saw that morph into where I think about every plan we work with, it's with a professional service corporation, incorporated or not, has a cross-tested profit-sharing plan and uses the 3% non-elective safe harbor and spends about 4.5% or so willingly on their employees in general in order for them to max out. And that's one thing we've always found in the personal service business industry is that they will spend whatever it takes to get what they want and are not unhappy to spend the 4.5 to 5 in profit sharing on their employees as long as they can max out. You know, what are your comments on that?
Going back, you know, pre-1980, we accomplished the same thing, Joe. Yeah, I started in the pension side of the business, okay? We were designing pension plans, back in that era, which, you know, the goal of the professionals typically were, hey, I want to get as big a pop as I can and give as little as possible to my employees. And
that hasn't changed.
Yeah. And if you read my history, I was actually considering going out of the business at that time, considering other opportunities. And, you know, my faith is a big issue, which has been documented in a lot of things that have been published. And so I was, you know, exploring, you know, potentially connecting into a Christian college or university or whatever. And it was when I was in that discovery process that the 401k thing hit and re-energized me. And the reason it re-energized me is 401k isn't a big deal to senior people, you know, big companies. Now, your professional market you're talking about is a whole different animal. Your plans are they're tax driven. They're not retirement plans. You know, they're tax driven plans. But you know, when you get away from that market, 401k is really a middle America, you know, plan. You know, it helps those earning 30 to 150, maybe 200,000, you know, do something meaningful in saving for retirement. And you know, that definitely re-energized me because that group needs the help.
Well, that's for sure. And so how about Roth deferrals? Do you like seeing people take advantage of the Roth deferral? And obviously, there's some tax bracket analysis. Some people, you know, it's facts and circumstances. But have you been pleased to see the evolution of Roth deferrals? And I think when was that? About 2006, they were made available the first time?
Yeah, the Roth is definitely oversold. I've written paper called To Roth or Not to Roth, that gives basically the things you have to consider in making that decision. And you know, Roth is the right way to go, certainly for some people. You know, you got millions of dollars of tax deferred money. You got to certainly think about it. But the thing that bugs me the most about it is, without getting to names, those big name financial people who will be on television and say, do you expect tax brackets to be lower or higher in the future? And then off of that, make the claim that, well, everybody should be putting their money into a 401, or I'm sorry, into Roth, because tax rates will probably increase. Well, when I did the last update last fall of my Roth or not to Roth paper, I went back and traced what has happened to tax rates since the time Roth was first introduced. And tax rates are actually substantially lower now than when Roth became effective. So, you know, individuals who played that game thinking they were going to get a big tax break, it hasn't worked out for them.
Yeah, I've written a couple things about that on LinkedIn. To me, it's astounding that most people don't know that, you know, a married couple making, filing jointly with a standard deduction, making a little less than $105,000 is not in higher than a 12% federal income tax bracket, and you actually have to spend, you have to have about $350,000 of income married filing jointly before you leave the 24% bracket. And so we've tried to encourage a lot of people do have imbalance with most all their savings in pre-tax accounts. And we try to get them to look at balancing that. And it seems to work sometimes, but it does require a lot of individual analysis. One thing good about millennials we've noticed is that the only thing they ever understand is Roth. And so they just look at it as, we'll never be taxed on this. And then I'll say, hey, did you ever hear about in the 80s, there was this thing called the excise tax or the success tax for too much retirement accumulations. Do you remember that, Ted?
Sure. Well, and the other things that come into play here in this as well is that, you know, if you're in a plan where you get a match, you want to contribute as much as it takes to get the match. And it's easier to do that if you're doing a pre-tax. So, you know, if you're not, you know, hitting the maximum and doing a Roth, well, that's a factor. Two other things is that very few individuals are going to have as much taxable income when they retire as when they're working. I mean, you know, the average person, their taxable income that they have is going to be a heck of a lot less. So therefore, you know, tax rates would have to escalate a lot before they're going to be in a higher bracket when they retire. And probably the last thing I'll mention on this is, to me, the goal when you're starting and you're working, you know, to build your nest egg, your goal should be to build it as fast as possible, you know, as large as possible, because life has many uncertainties. So when you're talking about looking 30 years out and, you know, making assumptions based on that, hey, you get into your late 50s, 60s or whatever, you know, there are a lot of things that can happen to turn your life upside down. You know, a divorce, a spouse dies, you lose your job, whatever. You know, all of a sudden now, wow, you need to start dipping in maybe, and you know, having a 30, 40, 50% larger balance is a lot more attractive than the fact that it's all Roth and may not have any tax exposure.
Yeah, and I'll chime in here as well. I know that one of your criticisms of 401ks currently is that participants, it's a little bit too easy to go in and withdraw those assets too early. And I think, you know, having those Roth assets can sometimes be a little bit more tempting than the pre-tax, because you can actually withdraw those contributions penalty-free versus with the pre-tax contributions, you're hit with that 10% penalty. You know, that may or may not defer people from taking that withdrawal, but I think, you know, removing the temptation where you can certainly helps.
Well, Ted, thanks a lot for joining us today. I hope that as things develop in the world of retirement that you come back and join us. We'd love to hear your words of wisdom as we move forward.
And Ted, I just have one last question. Are you an Eagles fan or a Steelers fan?
Eagles. I'm not all that wrapped up either way. But
okay. I was waiting for you to say it's hard to be an Eagles fan right now, Joe.
Well, I grew up in an area where I was a Pirate and a Steelers fan, and then we ended up in the Philly area for 37 years, and so my loyalty switched, you know, being in that area. But yeah, definitely not fun being an Eagles fan right now.
And I've been to an Eagles game, and the guy that took me said, "Do not wear a Cowboys jersey unless you want to die today." And so I didn't. And he said, and don't cheer for him either, or we'll get soaked with beer.
Yeah, well, I was at a classic Eagles Cowboys game, you know, back when the Eagles were horrible and the Cowboys weren't. And the Eagles got up, you know, by halftime. I don't remember what they were up by, 10 points or something like that. Played the whole second half just trying to avoid losing the game. And I Staubach was the quarterback, as I remember, driving him down the field for the winning touchdown, and the Eagles managed to pull off an interception and win.
Wow.
So, Ted, if people want to learn more about you and what you're doing, where's the best place people can go to learn more about you?
www.bena401k.com. That's my website.
Awesome.
Thanks, Ted.
Take care.
Talk to you soon.
information in this podcast is presented for educational and entertainment purposes only and is subject to change without notice. Opinions expressed are those of the participants and don't necessarily reflect those of Gordon Asset Management, LLC, its producers, hosts, or guests. Information presented should not be construed as tax, legal, or investment advice, or a recommendation or solicitation for the sale of any product or strategy. Listeners are encouraged to seek advice from qualified professionals to determine whether any information presented may be suitable for their specific situation. Investments involve risks. Neither Gordon Asset Management, LLC, nor its podcast participants shall be liable for losses resulting from decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on this podcast.